right, and here we are. This is the Working Title Show with Zach Sams, and we are back. We are back. This is the Working Title Show with Zach Sams, and it's like the end of April. I feel like we hadn't been here in a minute. What do you think?
We've been April. Yeah, it's April.
It's the 30th.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Today is currently May 15th, right? The day that's coming up?
We can't ask you any questions.
Okay, sorry.
But we are back. We have a special guest today. I'm really excited. And Elizabeth Jordan with the Human Impact. Is it CEO, founder? Is that what we're saying? Yeah. And I think some of you will remember that she was on our giving episode back in December. And Elizabeth, give us a little reminder what the Human Impact is and what y'all's mission is. So maybe jog some memories, and then those that didn't catch that episode will know what y'all are up to.
Yeah, I call my first 3 years when I was going to the streets of South Dallas, my research and development years. I went thinking of homelessness as people were lazy or they had lost jobs and they were there kind of for event-driven reasons. And I ended up discovering that people had a lot of grief that caused their homelessness. They would tell me their origin story of homelessness was oftentimes losing the person who was most important to them. And so we formed a mission of really friendship and relationships, because we believe that people are held in society not just by their finances, but by their relationships. And so we go to the streets and we really do meet people where they are, on curbs, under overpasses. We build trust with them over time. And then we walk this journey of healing with them. So it starts as friendship and it turns into advocacy for the people who want that, which involves a lot of the practical needs that people have, trying to help them, you know, get a job, get that medical issue taken care of. We work with landlords who will house the people that we are walking alongside. Mm-hmm. So that's the heart of it, though, is really friendship and relationship and that belief that we all need each other to really recover and live our best life.
Okay. So like, for example, I go down there and meet somebody, and what are the touch points? Like, how does that work? Like, you know, I've had a couple experiences like this where you feel terrible leaving and you're like, well, it's 8:30 at night and I got to get home to the kids. And like, how do you do that? And how do you also connect with them to like follow up? Because a lot of times they don't have phones. Like, what does that look like?
Well, we kind of invite people to lower the bar when you think about what it looks like to help someone that you pass on the side of the road, because I think we're used to being hit up for money. And I say that we dehumanize the homeless. We kind of see them as less than human, even though that's hard to admit. But they can dehumanize us when they just look at us as givers of stuff. So what we encourage people to do is, when you encounter someone, to prioritize human connection, which is like looking someone in the eye, learning their name. I'll literally like write down the names of the people I've met and try to remember them the next time I see them, and really just to have a human conversation. And a lot of times someone will expect I'm here to give them money or give them some stuff. And I'll just say, hey, that's not why I'm here today. I'm just here to get to know you, to have a conversation. Honestly, most people, you would be surprised, are like, thank you for taking the time to look at me. Thank you for taking the time essentially to see me as a person, because the people on our corners are so used to being passed by, because I think we feel awkward and we don't really know what to do. But that simple ability to look someone in the eye, to see them, to put your phone down, it's really, I think, in some ways a lost art. It's something that maybe we do more in our neighborhoods, but when we see someone on the side of the road, we're just not thinking about the simple ways to connect with another person.
So like, you identify Sally, for instance, and she's a new person that you've just met. And so now she's in, do you database them, or is there just the connection? There's no...
My team has a system that's just kind of on the back end, because we have a lot of different people working and having touch points with our different friends that we've encountered on the streets. So yes, there is like there's a method to how we work, but really the heart of it is trying to know the people. And then as we walk through the advocacy journey, kind of moving from trust and friendship into how can we help you move forward in your life? And something important on that, when I first started going out to the streets, I would look at someone who was struggling with addiction and I would try to kind of make them be ready to take those steps towards recovery. Well, it never went well because it turns out we can only really change ourselves, right?
Is that what you meant? Because earlier you were talking about, you know, as we move to advocacy, you said if they want that. Is that what you're talking about? Because some people might not want
that's right.
their situation helped, or I don't know exactly, but you mentioned they have to have they have to meet you somewhat halfway, I guess, is what you're trying to say.
Yeah, what I learned is that someone has to want their life to change. They have to be ready to take the steps that would be necessary to go in a different direction. And it's not because of maybe the stereotypes we have that people aren't ready to do that. A lot of people have tried a lot of times and they've been burned by the system. Or, you know, we have people who they will work for 3 months to get their birth certificate or their ID and the city will come out and throw all their stuff away. And people get discouraged. They get depressed. Some people are struggling with like an active addiction, but some people just start to use drugs and alcohol to cope with mm-hmm. the pain of their lives. And I don't know what human around can't relate to abusing or misusing something to cope with.
Self-medicating. Yeah. Sure.
So I think that answers your question.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like the alcoholic, they say, has to hit rock bottom before they want to actually improve their lives. So sort of similar context.
Have an office downtown for 30 years, you know, and you know, you see some corners that are worked by like professionals. They don't really want help, and that's their job. And sometimes they're driven and bussed in, or not bussed in, but taken to the site to, you know, they're like toll takers. Those are not your customers.
No. You know, panhandlers, it can be a business.
It is a business.
And not everyone who panhandles is not actually unhoused.
Absolutely.
But some people who panhandle are working it as a business.
Yes, for sure there are. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, I can think of some intersections and who the people are. Well, you know, and then there's other people that are unhoused for a day or two. And they desperately want to be that, you know, they've had a bad incident happen. They lost their job. You know, so you're dealing with a wide range of people, aren't you?
Yeah, that's a really good point. So when you think about kind of the big picture of homelessness, you have people like you're saying who they lose a job, they have some event that causes their homelessness, a medical issue wipes out their savings. They fall into homelessness. And this is 80% of people who become homeless. They're up and out of the homeless care system in less than a year. They need job training or placement. They need rental assistance for a period of time. But most of them actually never come back into the homeless system. Right. We're actually focused on a subset called the long-term chronically homeless that constitute about 20% of the homeless. And they're the people—
But use how much of the services?
What someone on the inside told me is 80% of the services. And kind of our hypothesis, what we believe is it's because we only think of addressing that issue in terms of economics, in terms of the shelter program service support, which is all good and necessary and we need, but we're missing this other key part, which is the relational ability to walk alongside someone through their ups and downs. And back to what you were talking about, a person really has to believe they're worthy. They have to believe that their life is worth something before they're going to take the steps to do something different in their life. And honestly, so much of our work is just getting to know someone well enough to look them in the eye and tell them all the good things about them that we see. It's really to encourage that person till they start to believe again that they're worthy of taking those steps towards healing.
Mm, that's a good point. You know, this is quote unquote kind of a real estate, you know, business podcast, but you know, and especially probably since post COVID and a lot of what we talked about with downtown real estate and the issues with downtown homelessness just comes up so much.
Even
now.
If it's only perception.
Yeah.
But I mean, because it is, you know, look at what the AT&T executive said is they lack confidence in the city's ability to restore kind of order downtown. And a lot of those complaints are centered on the homeless, you know, situation. Now, I think it was not, I mean, I've said this a bunch of times, T.C. Broadnax was by far the worst city manager and, you know, provided no leadership. That with the crisis of the pandemic, just the city sort of fell apart and people just quit going downtown because they have an association with that. So do you think that what you deal with, is it a downtown thing or is it an everywhere thing?
It's definitely everywhere. And because of all those issues, Housing Forward, they lead the homeless response system in Dallas. And they really worked very hard with a lot of different service providers to effectively end downtown homelessness a year ago. And I think the numbers are that there were the low 400s of people sleeping downtown to 14 as of last May. And so they really have worked hard to address those issues, like you were saying, and done a really good job at doing that. As far as real estate and kind of how does real estate play into, I guess, answering this question of how you address long-term chronic homelessness? 9 years ago, I went down to a tiny home village outside of Austin called Community First Village. And they had their first phase was 240 tiny homes. But what was interesting about them is they weren't just people coming out of long-term chronic homelessness. They were also people not coming out of homelessness who had discerned a call to live missionally there. And when I first went to this village, it was just this beautiful place. It was these tiny homes with these big porches that opened to each other. Everyone knew each other. And I thought, this is the human impact when we grow up. And since then, I've kind of been thinking, how could we do that? We've put some land under contract, different places, but we actually finally did purchase some land almost 2 years ago.
Oh, wow.
And we're developing our first small community that we're calling the Abbey that will house.
And where is it?
It's just about 5 minutes south of downtown.
Okay.
And it's in a neighborhood with some other nonprofits like the Men of Nehemiah, Cornerstone Baptist.
We did that. That's one of our projects.
Uh-huh. St. Philip's Community School. So we're in really good company.
How many homes are you guys going to build?
It's going to be 13 semi-attached homes. Okay. And an amazing architecture firm, SHM Architects, have designed the community pro bono. And it will be two homes for people who are not coming out of homelessness, who've discerned a call to live missionally. They're modeled after Community First Village. And that's about the back two-thirds of the community. And then the front third of the community will be community space where we'll serve the hundreds of other people that are still out on the streets. And then on top of it, we have some more temporary short-term dorm-style living for emergencies. Like, we'll have someone who will want to go to rehab. And right now we put them in a motel while we try to get them into rehab, but we could put them here. Women who are coming out of difficult situations, a place for people to stabilize. So I'm really excited about getting to see this come to life.
So how did you decide to go from being like me and H.P. Scott? Is this part of our, I hope, a part of our inner learn, go forth to serve? I mean, how were you called to decide to do this?
Yeah. I mean, calling would be the right word. It definitely wasn't the plan I had for my life. I was in the for-profit world after leaving college. And really, I don't know about the times in your life that you've gone through crises, but I went through both a personal crisis and a professional crisis at the same time. And for me, this has also been a faith journey. So I grew up in the church, but in my 20s, kind of went through this period where I wasn't sure if God was real and had a lot of doubts and questions. But when I went through these crises, including losing my dream job in the music and entertainment industry, I kind of hit my own rock bottom. And it caused me to go back to God and say, hey, my plans for my life aren't working out. If you made me, that means that you made me for a purpose. What are your plans for my life? And I basically said, like, if you'll show me your plans for my life, I promise to do whatever you ask me to do. And I could tell you a lot of stories of how I came to understand that I was called to the streets of South Dallas. And you can ask me about it if you want. But ultimately, there was a man named Larry James who led City Square.
Yep. Many years.
For two decades. And I was meeting with different nonprofit leaders trying to get a job in an already established nonprofit. And I think he honestly looked at this young white girl from Highland Park and thought, she doesn't know what she's getting herself into. He never told me that, but in retrospect, because he invited me to come to the streets because he was going out every Thursday between a bus stop and a homeless shelter, Austin Street Center, he said to get to know his neighbors. And so despite my better judgment, you know, I went very far outside of my comfort zone, met up with Larry one Thursday in July of 2013, and essentially never stopped going back.
Well, thank you for doing that.
Yeah.
It's been life-changing for me. You know, I think we go into situations like this, especially coming from a community where there's a lot of resources, thinking like, I'm going to help you. And that's not bad. It's not bad to go and say, like, I have a lot, I want to share it. That's a good impulse. But what I didn't expect is for my own identity and the way I saw myself to really get kind of restored and healed, because I had always judged myself on my success, my image, and all of these things. Well, that really doesn't go very far on the streets. Like, how successful you are and what you look like, people aren't super interested in that. People are really interested in authenticity, because if you can imagine losing as much as people who are experiencing homelessness have lost, you know, they just aren't dealing in the same things that I was used to dealing in.
It's been interesting, though, like you see, like Watermark's tried to, you know, they bought a DISD campus that had been in South Dallas, that had been totally closed in the neighborhood. Still, there's just a lot of distrust about why would you do this? And they're seen as outsiders. Well, you know, I spent a lot of money and time and have a lot of good intention, but it's not always well received by the people receiving the gift, if you will.
That's right. Yeah, we know them well and have done some things with them. There's some really good people over there. I think what I learned is when I first came to the streets, because I have never experienced poverty or homelessness, a lot of my ideas about what would be helpful were projections on people. And I think the best thing we can do when we're not coming out of that background is really be listeners. Because my first 3 years, I was able just to listen to people's stories, and I didn't really experience any success in the way that I would term success. And I really had to let go of my version of success and really redefine what it looks like to be successful. And for me, once again, it's really a part of my faith journey, but it's really about, to me, seeing the one person that God puts in front of me every day and choosing to love them. And I think that's something that whether you work under an overpass, which is probably not most people, right. Or you're in your own neighborhood, to have this kind of spirit of like, who's in front of me today? Is it my infant child? Am I supposed to like just tend to them today? Or is it my aging parent? Or is it my neighbor who just moved in? But I think there's just this invitation for all of us to kind of take a moment, take a deep breath, and to really attend to the people that come in front of us every day.
I think that needs to be a billboard. You need to put that on 75.
What would it say?
Who's in front of me? I need mm-hmm. to love them mm-hmm. today. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that.
You know, the homelessness, it's obviously not just a Dallas problem. We hear about it all over. You know, you hear on the news about all the billions they've given California or LA, and they're like, nobody knows what happened to the money and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, this is, you know, what I see, but, you know, it's like we think like this is a government problem. You know, the government should fix homelessness. And obviously, I would probably argue that they haven't done a great job at that. Now, maybe the California thing is more fraud than it is just not doing it right. But it seems to me that charities, private charities, do far more better good, and churches do way better good in these scenarios than government does. And so,
but they don't have the authority or the power to implement it.
Yeah.
And there's so many roadblocks for groups to, you know, I mean, it's not easy to be able to get a building permit and build these things. And there's all these building codes, and there's so many obstacles that thwart people from doing good.
Right. Well, I think we look at it wrong, and like, you know, I'm sure that there is a role that government can play. But when you actually look at, you know, how do you truly, it's probably a problem that can't be solved, because, you know, people are going to fall into homelessness for different reasons. And we have no control over what choices people make and how they end up getting there. But I guess solving it would be, you know, more people are pulled out of homelessness than are in it at any given time. So how does it work? What, in your opinion, how would Dallas do a better job of, you know, from a public and a private partnership to, you know, to do the work that you're doing, and, you know, and us be able to at least say, man, we've really, you know, we're really tackling this problem, and let's not be the LA that, you know, well, we put $20 billion to it, but nobody knows where it is, and we have more homeless than we did when we started. And like, how does that shake out for you?
We've made a lot of progress in the last 6 years.
And the numbers you gave, 400 to 14, that blew me away. But does that just mean that we've, you know, hid them away in hotel rooms and they're not on the street, or is something really happening?
They move the Bachman area. I mean,
part of it is they're just not where we see them, but are those 400 people literally not homeless anymore? Or are they just somewhere else?
Well, a little bit of history before I get to your question. So from when I started in 2013 to 2020, Dallas's response to homelessness, both governmental and the nonprofit world, felt very disorganized and disjointed. In 2020, there was a new head of the Meadows Foundation, a man named Peter Miller. And Peter Miller came into Dallas and said, I want to tackle homelessness. And everyone said, you're crazy. Well, he ended up getting Community Foundation, Meadows Foundation, and a lot of others to come together and hire a consulting company outside of Houston called Clutch Consulting that had made great progress in Houston. Clutch came to Dallas. They helped us reorganize our whole system. So we are much more coordinated. I would say we're doing really good. We're humming as far as people talking to each other, us working well together. But you're asking, I think, what is a deeper question? And it's a question I really love, because I think that neither government nor nonprofits can actually solve this issue. And I really believe in the work that we're doing. But what I really think is that society has to change the way that we see homelessness. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, when you don't think rightly about an issue, you actually aren't designing the right solutions. And so I believe as a society, we need a massive shift in how we see homelessness. Mm-hmm. We have so many stereotypes and assumptions about people on the streets. They're continually passed over. Most of them have significant trauma and were raised in poverty, and then they end up on the streets. And then there's the daily trauma of being passed over and, you know, not seen really as a full human being. And I really believe that until society, until we choose to treat people on our street corners differently, someone's compared it to like talking about mental illness, which is, a different issue. But what a taboo it was, 15 years ago to say I struggle with anxiety or depression. And there was enough of a public consciousness change to be able to say, like, I need help. And in the same way to say, like, you can't just ostracize a whole group of people and expect to really be effective in this issue. And I have a leadership coach named Robin Pugh, who I worked with for a long time.
Good H.B. Scott.
Yeah, he's an H.B. Scott. And he says, thoughts lead to actions and actions lead to results. And I think this is really true here, because we want to go and we want to address actions. We want to change what we're doing. But until we change our thinking, we're not going to have the right actions and we're not going to turn out the right results. And I am very passionate about this. We are actually in post-production on a documentary because we have a BHAG, Big Hairy Audacious Goal, of impacting, changing the natural conversation on homelessness to really include this relational support that people have to be seen and loved and cared for if we really want to heal this issue in our nation.
Yeah, I remember when Laura Miller was the mayor and Laura kind of had like bimodal results. Like, she did some really great things, and including getting Mike Rawlings to be the homeless czar. That was the first time the city had even acknowledged that it was a problem. I mean, I officed in the 500 South Irve building that was at that time, that was where the feeding, I mean, it was the epicenter of that area. It was rough, before the bridge. Then Mike went on to be the mayor. But, as a city, we didn't even acknowledge this until kind of the early 2000s. It was like, we're going to ignore it. Like, mental health problems. So, like, I don't know. I mean, maybe we're still at a very juvenile stage in terms of a city of, like, acknowledging, well, what is this, and much less how do we fix it?
It's such a big problem, though. Then the Human Impact is a perfect organization to, like you said, it's until you change the hearts and minds of the other people, not the homeless, that, like we've talked about in the past, you and I specifically, about when you get engaged with someone that's having issues getting ID, having issue, they just got their wallet stolen, they don't have a phone, they haven't showered, like, where do you take them to take it? Like, there's so many things that are logistically impossible for them that we take for granted every day, like taking a shower. Like, oh, I got a meeting, I got to run and take it. I had a guy that it took me 5.5 hours to get him showered up. And, like, we didn't know where to take him. We didn't, like, it was a whole thing.
For them to take him to Winners, I've gone down and
thought about it.
I've gone down and interviewed some at the public library, which effectively is sort of an emergency place, and you have to kind of, people don't want to give their names, this year I've finally gotten enough people who are willing to talk to you about, they're reluctant to admit they're not doing well. Mm-hmm. I mean, nobody likes to admit failure very much, even when it's obvious, Yeah, I agree. Here's a question too. Dallas has a housing crisis, whether it's the unhoused or people that are at 80 to 100% AMI, but no one in the city is willing to take affordable housing. And the communities that are the most averse to it are the ones south of I-30. They do not want affordable housing. So how do we deal with the fact that we have a housing shortage and no one is willing to allow affordable housing.
I mean, I think this is the upstream issue that causes homelessness and causes our issues with homelessness. I think the stat that I've most recently heard is we have 40,000 too few affordable housing units. Okay. So unless we're willing, to your point, unless we're willing to address the affordable housing crisis that we have in our city, we're going to keep creating homelessness.
And
it's a symptom of a problem.
It is. And, you know, we have the ability. There's a lot of land that's not expensive. It just happens to be in the South, and people are very upset about it. They would be there. You can't do an affordable housing project in the North largely because the land's just too expensive. But I understand that's viewed, when you view that through a racial lens, that argument, you know, that it's a real estate, but it is a real estate problem. It's a huge real estate problem. I mean, I wish the city would have a more robust means of letting developers pay into a fund where maybe even private developers could use it to do that. But I think this is part of that acknowledging that people that we need housing for. I mean, these are teachers and nurses and firefighters, and effectively, you know, we'll go in on a tax credit deal, and the neighbors, I mean, man, talk about getting shot with arrows. Oh, not, you know, everybody's for housing except when it's near them.
Mm-hmm. It's true. It's true.
So, well, I'm glad you see the same connection, because particularly that AMI 60% or lower, these are not people with savings. Their car stops working. They can't get to work. They can't get their kids to school or to daycare. And you know, I think the most tragic thing downtown I see is, you know, these, you know, people with children that are homeless. It's just
tough to see that.
Oh, it's awful.
I know. And I do wish as a city, we could do something to make that possible and easier for people to do and encourage that.
So I was talking to another nonprofit group recently, and he was telling me that he kind of dismissed the homeless problem for the future because he said, oh, we've made some big changes in the city this year that are going to be implemented in the next six months to a year that are going to end homelessness in Dallas. Do you have any idea what he's talking about?
I have not heard anything like that.
I'm going to have to do some more research.
I've heard the same thing about code enforcement and everything else. I mean,
talk
is cheap.
Well, apparently there's a plan being put in place that he said homelessness is going to be a thing in the past.
Well, if that happens, then we should talk again because that would be exciting to talk about.
Well, I always wonder, does that mean we just, like I said earlier, are we just not seeing them or has it really been cured? Let me ask you this. So, you know, you hear about, there's a good portion of people that are on the street that, you know, that are mentally ill. And that could be a very wide spectrum from I have some anxiety to I'm schizophrenic. And you hear it brought up in the news or different places like, well, we did away with insane asylums, which that word just sounds like, you know, but, you know, if somebody's literally insane, you know, that's a hard person to get a job for was there a mistake made by fully getting rid of these insane asylum type of places, for lack of a better term? And, you know, is that something that needs to be looked at again?
That's going to be a good short.
Yeah.
What they were called. I don't know what we call them today. Rehabilitation centers or.
It's such a complicated question because what you're talking about is taking people against their will. Even if we know their will is not intact. I mean, we've had friendships with people who are literally using the restroom on themselves. They're living in complete squalor.
Right.
And we would call Adult Protective Services, which is a thing, to come out. But as long as they can talk coherently in that moment, they cannot be taken against their will.
Right.
So I think it's really like a philosophical moral question. Do we want to be a country that takes people against their will? And you know, you asked us before and circled back to it as we started to talk about.
Well, some of those people can be dangerous, right? But they have to do something in order to be at that point taken against their will. So somebody has to be victimized badly or something, which is, you know, so there's, that's very complicated.
Yeah, and it's very person by person. And it's sometimes hard to know, is it a drug or alcohol abuse problem, or is it a true mental illness? They're just, it's very complex when you think about the individual person and how we handle things like that. But a question that you had asked and brought back up is, are we just kind of hiding people away? And that's a real legitimate thing. There have been some of the housing developments that we've done that I visited our friends who used to be on the streets that literally feel like we're warehousing people. And, you know, like there's pee in the elevators. It's only people coming off of the streets in a community. And really the best kind of way to house people is in a mixed income, a mixed kind of situation where people are coming from different backgrounds. And those are the most successful ways that we can get people off of the streets and into housing. So there are situations like that. And also there has been some pretty big and new developments in our work the last couple of months. On January 22nd, we were out on the streets and there was like a, it looked like a kind of like a sting operation of, I don't know, 40 cops on the streets. And when I parked, ended up seeing one of our friends and many other people, they had their hands zip tied behind their backs. So the Dallas Police Department has formed a new team called the Hot Team.
Is that for all the really good looking cops?
Tyler, didn't you have their talent?
I'm thinking Charlie's Angels, you know, like Hot Team.
That's exactly it.
Nice.
How did you know? That's really where I was going with the story.
Okay.
The Hot Team. So what's the Hot Team doing?
Yeah, well, besides looking good, they are... they basically, what they're doing is they're going into encampments and they're rounding people up in the morning and they're zip tying their hands behind their back, and then they line them up against a wall and kind of index everybody into the system. And if it's your first time getting round up, you have a choice to either go to shelter, or if you refuse shelter, you go to jail. But if it's your second or third time getting rounded up, you're taken straight to detention. And so this has been a really interesting...
Where we also don't have room.
We don't have room in detention centers. We don't have room at Lucerit. We are straight out of room right now in our jails. And the problem with this approach is that it actually doesn't help end homelessness for people.
Yeah, I don't see how it would.
So people get rounded up. They get zip tied. In this specific day on January 22nd, there were almost 50 people, and they're literally watching the... skid steers, what are those things?
Yeah.
They come through and they're destroying all their stuff in front of their eyes. So not only are they zip tied and getting killed, they either have to go to shelter or jail, but they're watching all of their stuff get destroyed. And one of the guys had worked for months on getting his birth certificate. He had just gotten it.
And it was in there.
It's in there. And so, you know, he said it feels like starting at ground zero of homelessness. And so I think we need to be asking the question, like, what are we really trying to do? Are we trying to get people off the streets? And if we're really trying to get people off the streets, this pushes people way back in the process of actually trying to resolve their homelessness.
I think that's not always what they're trying to do. They're trying to make the property owners in that area happy, and it just moves it on. You know, it's much how Dallas deals with bad employees. They have a term for it at the city called pass the trash. They just have to go from one department to the other. They don't get rid of them. And the person that's not good in Department A is often worse in Department B. So, you know, I mean, this is just kind of one of the problems. I do think our city manager now, she works, she lives downtown, you know, this is like, you know, a big ship. It takes a long time to turn it around. And I think morale is slightly better at the city, but there are still lots of employees that don't care. And, you know, I'm just doing my job. And it's all that kind of big picture thinking. It's hard to get a lot of people to buy into, you know, how do I solve affordable housing? How do I solve the homelessness? And a lot of these things are like, they're the same issue.
But that's why these podcasts are important, right? If we don't actually have these hard conversations, how are we going to solve them? Like, we need more people to know about them and care about them for the good of the city, because...
Yeah, I mean, the bond election that coming up for the ISD is important. Yeah, we need kids, you know, I mean, I still am a longtime believer in that eighth grade dropout rate is a predictor of how many, you know, beds you'll need in prisons. And that goes back to maybe the 1930s or something. The theory still's largely... I mean, maybe not exactly perfect, but I bet you if you looked at those numbers too, that the number of people don't have homes, there's probably a correlation to they didn't have a lot of education. Not always, but I just got to believe that's part of the problem.
That's right. I mean, most people were raised in under-resourced communities, and there's a saying that goes around. People say, like, anyone could become homeless. And I like to say, well, not people like me. Like, it would be very difficult, both financially and then to not have a safety net, to not have a relational safety net of people that would take me in.
Friends, some family that would,
help me out. Or someone who has a connection that I know that I could get another job. But when you grow up in an under-resourced community, it's just the fall is a lot smaller. It's a lot shorter than it is for someone like me. I'd have to fall a really long way.
Is that what you're talking about with the mixed communities? Because if you're in a mixed community, you have people that are on a higher socioeconomic level. So maybe you're on the bottom, but you meet these people and then you, now you have a strong, you have other people that, hey, you know what? You're actually a good dude. So you're doing good stuff. We're looking for somebody at our company. And so they start making those rises in life because they're interacting with people at different levels of society or, you know, income levels or whatever. Is that where you're getting at?
Try to go to the suburbs and get an approval to do a mixed income subdivision.
I'm sure it goes real well.
$700,000 houses and $300,000 houses. No way. Nobody wants those. You know, and that's how we've sort of organized all the United States is by bands. The people in the 300 to 400 band live together, and these people live here, and these people live here.
Yeah, these would have to be massive shifts in the way that we think
about how people think
and address
issues. I think it's deeper than that. It's a faith thing that I was talking to some folks at our church that they want to get involved, they want to help, I had this epiphany looking around at a mixed-use project going like, wait, we put these mega churches over here surrounded by massive parking lots and they're locked all week long. And then on Sunday, they're full and those people are like, what do I go do? And then you have to get in your car and drive to the need. And we don't have enough micro pockets of like, here's a big mixed-use project with retail and a grocery store and some housing and maybe a couple affordable houses and, a church, a smaller church over here. And so these people that go to this coffee shop that also, hey, you want to come to a Bible study? You want to, like, it's just not connected.
And
Sunday morning is the most segregated by both race and income.
What is
time? Sunday morning is the most segregated in the United States by both race and income.
Hmm.
And it's seen little change in my 55 years of life.
And this is why I would say I believe it comes back to relationships, because as long as people are just a statistic or even to serve behind a food line, which is a good thing to do, but it really is not transformative. And if we don't know people who are different race, culture, socioeconomic status for us, if they can't really become a true person, a full person to us. When that happens, when we have relationships with people kind of across the lines, it begins to change everything, really. It changes how we think about what we have. It changes how we think about what we give. There are just so many things that I think can't get transformed without relationship. And we all know this. I mean, the most impactful things in our lives, when we're going through the hardest time, it's the people around us that hold us up. And so our real push is that people would take a minute to roll their window down and get to know someone's name. And if it's a person you pass consistently, to start to know them. And you've had a lot of experience doing that. And I think having that person's name and maybe getting the chance to hear a little bit of their story, what you realize is that they are still fully human and they actually have gifts to offer us. We tend to think of people in kind of socioeconomic need or in homelessness as people without anything to give us because we're just thinking materially.
Well, and that's flipping the script. It's, I'm going to go help these people. Mm-hmm. And you spend some time and you go,
they're helping
man,
you more.
Man, I've just, like, I'm so much richer and like more humble, and I appreciate things more when I realize the things that God's blessed me with, but also like, why is this guy happier than I am? I'm struggling with things that don't matter today. And this guy is singing a tune and he's skipping and he's homeless. And it's just like, wait, maybe my priorities are messed up. So, well,
and our kids need to see us do this. Like, we live in such a digital age where they're not connecting as people. They need to know their lives matter. They need to be invited into these stories with us of being able to transform someone else's life and have their lives transformed. You know, I was out on the streets. I've been out on the streets twice this week, and two times, it's like a theme this week, people have said essentially like, I don't complain, or I choose not to complain. And there are people who are, you know, living in homelessness. And the first guy I really stopped and said, like, that's a really interesting word choice. Why did you say I don't complain? And he said, well, a year ago, I was on a ventilator for 12 days. And here I am alive. And someone always has it worse than me. And so I choose not to complain. And I just thought, like, wow, I really need to learn from you. And what I want to say is, if we could see the men and women on our streets as people that have a wealth to offer us that we really can't get, or at least I can't get with all the financial resources that I have at my disposal, if we could see them as having a wealth that we actually are pretty desperate for in our society, and if we could go to them as learners, we would be enriched. Our lives would be enriched and transformed. The lives of our families would be changed. You know, we want to raise kids who, as our Highland Park High School, enter to learn, go forth to serve. Yeah. We want to raise kids who are not just looking out for themselves, not just looking out for their tribe, but are looking at the greater good. And I think as parents, if we bring them along when they're children, they really get to see a different way of being. And I'll say it again, they get to know that their lives matter because they live in this high comparison world, and they're always, you know, it's really hard in the social media age to not be comparing yourself, to not be thinking how you live up to others. But when you get out in real life and you meet someone face to face and you have a conversation and you realize you made them smile or they made you smile, your kids get this sense of like, my life matters. And then they get to take that back into their own communities. And then we get to raise kids who, when there's a lonely kid at the lunch table, they've learned they've learned how to see people that other people don't see, and they've learned how to extend welcome and an invitation. And so I think kind of crossing these cultural or racial or socioeconomic barriers actually teaches us to be better neighbors in the communities that we live in.
And the longer you do it and the more you expose yourself, it's funny when you go back and you sit at the dinner party and these super trivial conversations, I can't take them anymore. I sit there and go like, what are we talking about? Like, this is like your third trip to Cabo in 3 months. Like this, none of this matters. And I want to go back because these guys or gals or whoever, they've got more depth.
And I think that's just like, you know, it's super fun to go to Cabo. I'd love to go, you know, but also
that's our new deal. We're going to take all the homeless people in Dallas, Cabo.
Perfect. But I think,
you know, you bring it up that made me think earlier. I remember my late friend David Kunkel told me when he was police chief and then later city manager in Arlington, do you know what they told their cops to tell the homeless? Go to Dallas. They'll take care of you there. And I believe still suburban cities do that. That's what they believe.
Well, Chicago buys one way tickets to Honolulu.
Yeah.
And they send them straight to Hawaii. And
I'm serious.
I'm serious. Well, on a Southwest flight to Honolulu.
What I wanted to say is, like, one thing I think people need to know is like, you're made for this. Like, you're actually made to cross these barriers or step out of your comfort zone and take a risk. And it's actually going to be so fulfilling. And some of the worries that you have when you actually kind of go farther than you've gone before and you get fulfilled, they're going to kind of quiet because you can't help but talk to someone who's appreciating just the fact that they woke up today and they roll out of a tent and not go back to your own home and think differently about the things you wish you had. You just can't.
What are some misconceptions? So, you know, people might feel like, you know, I don't want to roll down my window and give money to this person because they're probably scamming me. Or, I watch the news and I see the psychotic homeless person kill the person on the subway. And so they're, I don't think anybody's wrong to want to protect themselves or not put themselves in a bad situation. So how do you square that with people and how could they, you know, if they're thinking, I'd like to do this, but I don't know how to do it. And, you know, I don't want to put myself in a bad situation or I don't want to get scammed. Like, do you have any thoughts there?
Yeah, I like to encourage people to treat someone on the streets like a regular stranger. And when you're thinking about how you just approach a person in general, we have a couple of steps that we walk through that we're unconscious of. And they're steps like looking someone in the eye. And if you look me in the eye back, that's an indication that maybe there's a chance for connection. So if someone looks me in the eye, the next step I'll take is to say like, hello, or how are you? If they respond,
smile at them.
If they respond to that, then I'll say, is now a good time to come over and talk to you? I'll ask for permission to enter that person's space because a lot of the violence that happens is because someone feels threatened or afraid, or maybe they are struggling with a mental health issue and you've kind of just invaded their privacy or their space. And really, I say that we kind of lose our regular brain when we are thinking about homelessness, but you know how to do this. It's really actually very intuitive if you can just think about the way you would treat any stranger and you would just sort of assess generally, is this person warm? Are they ready to have a conversation with me? You know, is it a good time to have a conversation with someone else? And then kind of if you get there, if you get that far where you're going to be talking to someone, I encourage people to like take a seat on the concrete, kind of like get on someone else's level and just be willing to have kind of an eye to eye, face to face conversation with someone. There's a lot of respect and dignity that comes in kind of just being right where someone else is. And if they're kind of quieter, but you know that they want you, you can start to talk about yourself. I'll say like, hey, I have three kids, or I grew up in Dallas, or, you know, when the Cowboys are playing, like they lost again, crap, you know, like all those kinds of things.
That part's easy to say. Yeah. Is it easier to make them better or end homelessness? They're both very hard things.
Yeah,
exactly. Might be easier to end homelessness. Really. Oh, you can tackle that next.
I that would be great.
Pun intended.
Yeah.
Football joke.
Well, I think that's helpful. We're at time, but thank you so much for coming on and sharing.
And thank you for all you're doing for the community. You definitely get the good HP Scott Award. You really are going out and serving. It's nice to see. Thank you.
Thank you.
If somebody's from HP, they have to sit over there in Dallas. If you're in the nosebleed part of the world, you get to sit over here. Wichita Falls, Argyle, Denton.
Y'all are our Westerners.
Yeah.
And can I tell people how to learn more about us?
That's exactly where I was going. Tell us how to find you and how if somebody wants to get engaged, they do that.
You can find her right there.
Hey.
What if you're not here?
Okay.
Yeah. Oh.
That joke wasn't that good.
No. We'll leave
jokes to Dallas.
Cut.
I mostly only laugh at my own jokes, so I think jokes like that are funny.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I appreciate it.
You can go to thehumanimpact.org and learn a lot about us that way. You can follow us on any social media platform at The Human Impact. You can follow me at Elizabeth Jordan. I'm Elizabeth with an S. We are really trying to give people a lot of these tips and tricks of how to engage and how to think about this issue in kind of short form content. Like I said, we're working on a documentary and a community.
When does that come out?
Well, I should see a cut of it in the next couple of weeks, but we plan to broadly release it. We're going to use it in the next year and a half, but broadly, we want to release it kind of heading into the holidays of 2027. And we're hoping that the Abbey opens for Christmas of 2027. So those two things will have some synergy working with each other. And we hope that the documentary premieres coast to coast, and we're going to have a call to action and a playbook that comes alongside people across the country with how to do our work where they are. As simple as how do you engage someone on the side of the road or know if it's a good time to have a conversation, to how do you start to help them through a process to get off of the streets and into housing, to like if you wanted to start your own community. A lot of churches have land that they're not using and they may want to just house a couple of people. And so we really want to provide people a step-by-step process of how they can do what we're doing somewhere else.
Well, do you have any events coming up soon that people might be able to come to or visit you at?
On May 10th, is that a Saturday? Does that sound right to you?
The first is a Friday, so that sounds like that would be
the 9th, a Saturday. Saturday, May 9th,
Saturday,
if that's right. Someone needs to fact check me. But we have an event called Come to the Table. And Come to the Table is a shared meal between the unhoused, the housed, families come. It's this really cool space called Lofty Spaces in South Dallas. And what's different about what we do is we just eat family style. So it's all of us at a table together just having a meal. And it's Mother's Day themed. So bring the moms in your life and come and, you know, honor your mother, bring your kids. Like I said, there's so much for the kids to do and run around, and it's like fenced in. So kids can get energy out, and it ends up being an incredible time. We do party favors instead of like gift bags just for the homeless, because we're trying to say everyone's equal here. And so the kids will get, you know, eat all the candy from the gift bags, and everyone leaves happy and full.
Nice. Saturday, May 9th.
Yes.
See you all down there.
Yeah, and we can we'll link to your website.
Y'all should all come.
Let's do it.
I would like to. Thank you.
Thank you
for coming. I'm sorry it took us so long to get you back, but I'm glad you're here.
Me too. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. This has been the Working Title Show with Zach Sams. We'll see you next time. Thanks.